From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with guitarist Ron Wood. Wood has been a member of the Rolling Stones for the past 12 years, and before that played with Rod Stewart and the Jeff Beck Group. He's also an artist with a new book of paintings and drawings. Also today, I speak with John Doe and Exene Cervenka of the band X. They were associated with the LA punk scene in the late 70s, but their collaboration outlived that scene. Their sixth album is called See How We Are. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the latest album from bassist Dave Holland and his quintet. And television critic David Bianculli checks how this season's flock of new shows has fared. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The Rolling Stones made the American charts in 1964, and since then they've remained one of the most popular rock and roll bands in the world. They've proven the power and longevity of rock and roll. My guest is Ron Wood, who has played guitar with the Stones for the past 12 years. Before that, he played for 7 years with Rod Stewart and Faces, and for 5 years with the Jeff Beck Group. Before he became a professional musician, Wood went to art school and planned to become an artist. He continued to draw while he was on the road touring with his bands. His sketches of friends and fellow musicians illustrate his new book. It's titled Ron Wood by Ron Wood, The Works, and it's just been published by Harper & Row. The Rolling Stones are in hiatus now, and Ron Wood is currently touring with Bo Diddley. Before we talk to Ron Wood, let's listen to him play. This is The Rolling Stones and Shattered.
Surviving on the streets, look at me, I'm in tatters, I'm shattered, shattered. Friends are so alarming, and my love is never charming. Life's just a cocktail party on the street. Big apple, paper dress, plastic bags, directed traffic, some kind of fashion.
I guess Ron Wood featured on bass and guitar on that recording. Ron Wood, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, like so many British musicians, you started playing in a skiffle band, which is kind of like a jug band, and you also went to art school. And I don't know what it is about English musicians that they always share these two things, playing in skiffle bands and going to art school.
A lot of them went to art school, didn't they?
Davis. Is art school different in England than America that so many musicians go there?
I don't know so much about being different, but it's a much smaller piece of land. There's a lot more people concentrated in areas that small concentration of people around London. I remember I used to see Pete Townsend, and I even saw Keith Richards once. When I was at art school, he'd come into the canteen there, you know, sort of. He was going out with a girl from my college, I think.
So how did you first hear rock and roll?
How did I first hear of it?
Yeah, how did you first start listening to it?
My eldest brother, Art, he used to have a band that was an early R&B band in England, called Cyril Davis and Alexis Corner. And funnily enough, Charlie Watts was their drummer. The Stones got me from there. But I used to go and watch Art in his various bands in little pubs and little back rooms. And the drummer of the Cyril Davis band was a guy called Carlo Little. He had this leopard skin drum kit.
Great.
I was still in short pants, and this guy used to, when they'd done a set, he'd come off the stage and tell me about people like Chuck Berry and Howlin' Wolf and stuff. And he gave me a few of my first records like that. And because they were really hard to get in England, the real kind of collector's pieces.
Well, let's jump ahead a few years to when you joined Rod Stewart in Faces. In your new book, Ron Wood by Ron Wood, you say that Faces is really one of the bands that pioneered hotel destruction. I thought that was pretty interesting. How did that all start, tearing up the hotel rooms?
Well, it wasn't just done in careless abandoned. It was usually sparked off by some annoying person in the hotel, either the person behind the front desk who really didn't want us there, or I remember one of them in Detroit. She worked in Holiday Inn. Her name was Mona. And I was speaking to Bo Diddley about where he got that song title from. And he said he got it from this woman that was in reception that really hated him. And that was in Detroit too, but it wasn't in the same hotel. But it was just still a nice little coincidence. He wrote this song about this woman that was really a bad vibe. Anyway, the destruction bit usually came from the smaller members like Mac and Kenny Jones, Ronnie Lane, Stevie Marriott. They've all got this kind of defense mechanism, being shorter type people. And if someone annoyed them, like breakfast room service or something, if they got the eggs order wrong or something for three times in a row or something, Mac would start, you know, he was pretty aggressive, start pulling the phone out or trash the breakfast or something. But that was like a reaction where I used to go and calm him down more, you know. But we used to do more things like seeing how many people we could get in a hotel room and cause a nasty accident where everyone would fall on the floor. And that. It was kind of all innocent fun. Keith Moon used to do the real kind of destruction. We used to do rearrangement of hotel furniture, which I liked. We used to take everything out of the room and set it up in the hallway or something, like a complete suite, all pictures on the walls and TV going and the lamps and the furniture.
I'm sure the hotels didn't want you to stay there after a while.
Well, yeah, also being so far away from home, like we were all pretty young and pretty homesick, we used to get very bored as well.
You said that you used to start checking in under the name Fleetwood Mac since they had a better reputation. So that was pretty funny. Do you still do that now at hotels? I mean, have you given that kind of thing up or still do it?
Oh, it just goes with the atmosphere of the hotel. I find nothing upsets me in hotels these days. It's fine. I don't do it. It's rather corny anyway to keep doing that kind of thing.
Kind of immature, actually.
Yeah.
You know, from the civilian end, I think it really gave rock stars the reputation of being really spoiled, as opposed to really rebellious, but really spoiled, like, oh, the eggs weren't prepared properly. Let's trash the room.
Well, I would, it's all right for me to sort of pretend like I had nothing to do with it, but I would never get like that. I think if I got a frustration on the phone or something, then I might have smashed the phone, but, I mean, it's nothing like completely emptying the contents of the room out the window or something like Keith Moon used to do. I mean, he was a genuine madman.
Let's talk about joining the Rolling Stones in 1975. Now, what happened? Let's just explain, because it's a little difficult to keep up with, I think. You joined the Rolling Stones on a kind of interim basis in around 75 when Mick Taylor was leaving.
That's right. I remember doing two tours with the Faces that year and one tour with the Stones. Played to a lot of people that year. But what it was, you see, neither Jagger, who I was speaking to directly then about joining the Stones, or myself wanted to split the Faces up as a unit, because I had too much respect, and so did he, for the rest of the boys, and I didn't want to leave them in the lurch kind of thing. Although, if I'd have been very cold about it, I could have just got up and left. But I wouldn't do that.
What did it mean to you to join the Rolling Stones? Had you been following their music for a long time? Were you still a little bit in awe of them, even though you had been on the road for so long yourself?
Yeah, I was. They were a big source of my inspiration musically. I remember the Faces used to warm up in the dressing room to sort of get your yah-yahs out and stuff. You know, we used to just get the spirit of the rock and roll thing from the Stones a lot, which still goes true to this day. I still am a bit in awe of them, rock and roll wise, because they're just a unit which says a lot for rock and roll, doesn't it?
They were going through something of an identity crisis, I think, when you joined. It was 1975, 76. And it was right before the period when punk really started catching on. And I think once punk really caught on in England and America, that the Rolling Stones for a while were seen as the smug establishment. You know, the thing that punk musicians were reacting against. Did that put you guys in a really awkward position? I'm sure you weren't used to being seen as the establishment. You were the rebellious ones. But now there was a younger generation of musicians coming up.
Yeah. We didn't hold any malice or any bad feeling to the punks calling us boring old. I'm probably not allowed to say it on the air.
Probably not.
So it just shows you what a gentleman I am, isn't it? Well, you know, they used to call us all these kind of names, but that was only their way of being heard and making a statement, which we used to do. People like Keith, I mean, he used to do through his music and his general attitude. He didn't have to spit or swear or get really gross. It was just in him to be a bit of a rebel. Even though he's a family man today, he's still got that in him.
I think of the album Some Girls, from which we just heard an excerpt earlier, as being the kind of Rolling Stones' answer to the punk music of the time. Because it really, really got a real edge again with that record.
That's right. Most of the songs were in A. Keith and I had given Mick a lot of guitar lessons at the time, so he was playing a lot of these songs like Shattered and Summer Romance and Where Do Boys Go, all those kind of songs were just like out and out punkish type songs.
Yeah. Initiated is probably the wrong word, but how were you initiated into the band when you joined it? What did you have to learn to become a part of it?
Oh, I'll get around to that in a minute. But in 74, when I was doing my first solo album, I used to hang out a lot with Mick. He used to come down to my basement studio in Richmond, in England. And he used to give me advice. I was saying, come on, Mick, you know, you're a vocalist. You're an LV, lead vocalist. Give me some advice on approaches. So when I did I Can Feel the Fire, he sang on that with me and he kind of coached me a bit. And at the same time, we got the song It's Only Rock and Roll together in the same studio. And we had Kenny Jones and Willie Weeks playing on that. And me and Bowie were singing background vocals and all that. So I had a kind of initiation into the group then by writing a bit with Mick and hanging out musically with him. And then Keith coming over for the evening and staying for 4 months. I knew he had some kind of lasting power. But in 75, when I actually started rehearsing for the US tour that year, we rehearsed for a month or so in Montauk. I had to learn about over 150 songs. And although I was a fan of the group before, I'd never actually sat down and played the songs. You know, I used to know them, but it's a different thing when you have to play them. So I had all these different chord sequences going around in my head, all different keys, all these songs from when they first started right up until where they were at the time. And that was very confusing too. But it was still very enjoyable.
What about how to perform on stage? Did Mick Jagger give you any ideas of things he expected you to do on stage when you were performing together?
Yes, but he'd never tell me what they were.
So, what would he do then?
I'd have to be forever on my guard and have my defenses up in case, because he'd creep up behind you and put your guitar out of tune or something if you weren't looking, or he'd kick you or trip you up or push you or something. I remember Charlie stopping the song a few occasions and saying, don't you hit my friend Woody again, otherwise I'll come over there and stick one on you.
So
that was quite funny.
Why would he do that? Why would he
just to keep you on your toes, and he loves someone to spar with. You know, I think Mick Taylor, although I love his guitar playing, he didn't really give any bounce physically to Mick on stage. You know, he was pretty inanimate there. He'd be playing great guitar and he'd be standing in one place, whereas I'd be like an artful dodger.
When the Rolling Stones perform on stage, there's Well, you even mentioned this in the book, that a lot of girls and women will throw panties onto the stage, things like that. What would you do with them? Would you leave them there afterwards? Do you take them with you? What do you
try
do
to give them back to their owner?
Find the owner?
By the end of your foot, you know. Oh, yeah, I mean, you wouldn't. Well, I mean, what are you going to do with them? Just kick them back there.
I'm sure you've been exposed to a lot of groupies over the years, and I guess I'm interested.
That's a dying race now.
That's what I wanted to know. Yeah. If it is, if that kind of scene really is changing because of sexually transmitted diseases and such.
Oh yeah, I mean, even before the way it is in this day and age, it's. There was a time when the late 60s, early 70s, when it was fully in its full swing with the groupies, male or female. There used to be some real characters, but don't really see them these days because everyone that you meet at a concert nowadays has got this kind of built-in... defense thing, like, oh, it's nice to say hello to you, but I know you only want one thing from me, so I'm leaving. You know, sort of, give us your autograph and I'm off. Which is cool. I don't mind.
My guest is Ron Wood, who's played with the Rolling Stones for the past 12 years. He's also an artist, and he has a new book that's a series of memories and stories about friends and fellow musicians, along with sketches of friends and fellow musicians. The book is called Ron Wood by Ron Wood. The works, and it's just been published. We'll talk more about his life and his music and his drawings after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Ron Wood is my guest, and he's been with the Rolling Stones for the past 12 years, has also played with Rod Stewart and with the Jeff Beck Group. When you joined the Stones, you were kind of credited with keeping the group together in a way. There was a lot of friction between different personalities in the band. Who was most at odds with who, and how did you fix
well,
things
I think
up?
After a group of people have been together for as long as, let alone as long as they've been together, now, but when I joined, they'd still been together for a long time, you know, to 12 years or so, whatever. There has to be a kind of a saturation point where everybody is still friends, but it kind of was a bit dull. I think I just put some life in there. I just kicked them up the backside a bit, and Bill Wyman pointed this out, I think, first of all, in a couple of interviews. That's why I got that kind of tag as the diplomat or the jester or whatever it was. I used to try and help keep any potential bad situation from manifesting itself too much.
You've said that you'd like to see the band continue to play, but to play smaller stages without all of the big theatrics and fancy stage
business. Well, it
doesn't
really matter how they play again, as long as they play again. That's what I want to make sure they do. I'm sure the kids would like to see that too, or the dads. It doesn't matter. I mean.
Did the theatrics start to get to you after a while? Did you not like playing the big arenas, or did any of the theatrics seem too much to you?
Not really, because with the Stones, if we'd have just played big stadiums all the time, then I would have got a little frustrated of kind of, why can't we get more in touch with the kids? Like I've just been doing with Bo Diddley, playing the small clubs. I mean, that was great. The kids are right there and you can, you know, give them five and try and get your trouser leg back. But that's good fun. And the Stones kept that element in by... We'd play the odd, very tiny club, like we did in Toronto, and in the last gig we played together, in fact, in the 100 Club, in London. That holds about 300 people. And it's nice to get them back into that early surrounding when I first saw them in the early days of, you know, the back of the bar, the pub atmosphere. And it's nice to see that they still want to do that occasionally. But obviously, you have to play big places from time to time. As long as they break it up, like, then there's a... They sort of do a happy medium between the clubs and the stadiums by playing places like the Fox Theatre. I remember it was great. And we did some small theatres like that.
Several members of the Rolling Stones have had drug problems. One of them, Brian Jones, basically overdosed. And I know you were in... treatment for a while, a few years ago, yourself. And
it was just to check myself out, you know, to make sure that we weren't going overboard or anything.
I guess I've always wondered if the members of the band ever try to keep each other away from drugs during hard times, try to, like, discourage people from really building up a habit.
Yeah, I remember when Keith was in his... dark cloud days, you know, when he was walking around perpetually under this cloud of dope, that even though he was out of his brain, he didn't endorse any of his, like, contemporaries who tried to keep up with him. He, you know, because a lot of people used to think, oh, it's cool, if I'm going to see Keith, then I've got to get on the borderline of life or death. You know, lots of times we used to see people used to overdose and sort of try and be clever by taking too much heroin, especially. It was terrible. We used to walk people around and save their lives. Keith used to ring me up. He said, quick, come down to my room. They're dropping like flies, you know. It wasn't really funny. And I guess when Keith did... get off the heavy stuff, that he breathed a huge sigh of relief and thanked his lucky stars that he made it.
The Rolling Stones, I think, were one of the first bands to really become international celebrities and to really make it into the establishment celebrity circuit. And I wonder how you think that affected the music, in the sense that I remember when the Rolling Stones first performed in America, and, oh, they seemed so so different and so, you know...
Ragged.
Ragged, yeah, and it was great. It was really exciting, and everybody's parents were really upset, but everybody who loved rock and roll thought this was just the most exciting thing that could possibly happen. But then, you know, it almost symbolized something when the Rolling Stones became these international jet-set celebrities.
Yeah. There was a time when the music was
kind of...
seemed to
be the opposite of that.
There was a time when the music seemed like it may get too polished. But underneath, everybody in the band still hasn't lost their roots, which were in the, you know, the Blues and the Muddy Waters and the Howlin' Wolf and Slim Harpo and, you know, just generally Chuck Berry'd and Bo Diddley'd. They haven't lost that. I just saw Keith the other day. And I saw Mick. I mean, they haven't really lost... any of that original earthy feel, you know. They never went quite as far, like the Faces. We used to forget to tune up. That was a little bit too much to take sometimes, I think. Or we were all perfectly in tune with each other, but not as a band.
Whenever people talk about rock and roll continuing in spite of age, you know, because people used to think, oh, rock and roll was the young people's music, but then everyone who listened and everyone who played it started getting older. The Rolling Stones are always mentioned in the same breath with that. And I wonder if that's something that those of you in the band have talked about a lot, you know, talked about, does the music have to change just because you get a little older? And if so, how does it change?
No, well, it's like a breath of fresh air. But a lot of the youngsters that started following the Stones when the Stones were a lot younger, the fans are still young at heart, even though they may be over 40 of the original ones. And then you get the whole two other generations below that and the one above that. So you get like four generations in Stones audiences these days.
What is the status of the band now? You're not disbanded yet. You're not exactly playing together either.
No, this is the very iffy time of, you know, we took a pause to let Mick basically do his solo stuff and get that off his chest, which I know he dearly wanted to do. And I think we're around the time now where he's done it a couple of times and he's exercised his option, as it were. And I think he's going to come back to the fold within the next year or two, you know. And I'm eternally optimistic about the band getting back together in the next few years. I think you'll see it. It'll be true.
Your new book has a lot of drawings in it, and you started off as an artist before you became a professional musician. Have you continued drawing all these years while you've been on the road with the different bands you've played in?
Yeah. Well, once again, since I was a little kid, I remember about 5 years old, I always used to copy my older brothers because they would draw during the day and maybe play a little bit at night with their art school friends. And I used to follow them from room to room. If they started drawing, I would annoy them by copying what they were doing and asking advice all the time. And when they played music, I would hang around in there and sneak up and play their instruments when they weren't looking and stuff. And then they used to let me play while they were looking. And I thought, oh, well, maybe there's a hope that I can play, you know. And then they used to encourage me. I started on the drums first, went on stage first at 9 years old playing the washboard. I got my early stage fright experiences then, and that feeling has never left me. I've always liked to play in front of live audiences especially, and I've always drawn in the time in between when, you know, like through the various bands that I've been in, I've always sketched the people I work with during studio sessions, like in the control room or on airplanes.
We only have a few seconds left, but I'm wondering, when you have an art show that opens, what it's like to be there alone with work that's yours and yours alone? Because you've always been a member of a larger unit, but when it's an art show, it's just you that's on the line.
It's a bit disorienting, yeah, you're right, because I'm always looking around for my amplifier and my guitar as well. But I just have to look to the walls and see these things move for themselves. But I'm in Philadelphia, I think I'm going to set up an exhibition as well to go along with all the other ones around the country. I got one in San Francisco coming up, LA, and Boston, Washington. Memphis is already going, so is Houston. Chicago, Detroit's happening as well, Miami.
Well, I wish you the best with it, and I want to thank you very much.
Thank you
talking
very
to us about your music and your life. My guest has been guitarist Ron Wood, and he's played with the Rolling Stones for the past 12 years. Before that, he was with Rod Stewart and Jeff Beck. He's currently on tour with Bo Diddley. He's just written a book that's basically an autobiography. It's called Ron Wood by Ron Wood, The Works, and it includes a lot of sketches and paintings of friends and fellow musicians. It's published by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, we'll feature a live concert with jazz alto saxophonist Frank Morgan. He recently returned to the jazz scene after a fairly long period of imprisonment on drug-related charges. He's just finished performing a series of dates at the Village Vanguard in New York. He also just finished starring in a play about his life in New York. He'll join us tomorrow for a live concert with pianist Ronnie Matthews and bassist Walter Booker, so I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, John Doe and Exene Cervenka of the rock group X talk about keeping their band together despite marriage and divorce, pregnancy, little airplay, and occasionally hostile crowds. The band's sixth album is called See How We Are. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews The Razor's Edge, the latest album from bassist Dave Holland. And TV critic David Bianculli checks up on this season's new shows and examines the relationship between first-season ratings and long-term success. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. Sporadic gunfire echoed through the streets of Haiti's capital city today, one day after the cancellation of that country's first election in 30 years. More than 24 people were killed over the weekend in violence that led to the cancellation. The State Department today clarified statements made yesterday by Secretary of State George Shultz that all non-humanitarian aid to Haiti would be cut off. A State Department spokesman said the aid, including military assistance, would be removed until the electoral process in Haiti has been restarted. Authorities report no new progress in talks to end the siege of a federal prison in Atlanta by Cuban inmates. One official said the inmates showed little interest in a deal that ended the takeover of a detention center in Oakdale, Louisiana. The Oakdale prisoners released their 26 hostages yesterday and began leaving the center today on their way to other facilities. Federal prison officials have agreed not to seek prosecution of rebelling inmates at Oakdale for the damage they caused. That promise was part of the deal that led to the release of the hostages. More from NPR's Frank Browning.
Bureau of Prisons Director Michael Quinlan said today that under the terms of the agreement reached with the Cuban inmates, they would not be subjected to further prosecution for the physical damage committed or for the act of seizing the hostages. Quinlan, however, did leave open the possibility of prosecution for specific personal threats to individual hostages. However, Quinlan said that so far there's no evidence that any such threats took place.
According to all of the hostages released from Oakdale, there were no such threats.
Quinlan refused to discuss ongoing negotiations with Cuban exile inmates in Atlanta, and he reiterated that the government would not use force against the inmates there so long as no hostages are hurt. This is Frank Browning in Washington.
A strong rolling earthquake measuring 7.4 on the Richter scale shook Alaska today and prompted tsunami warnings as far south as British Columbia. Tsunamis are potentially damaging waves generated by severe earthquakes. The earthquake's epicenter was 300 miles southeast of Anchorage in the Gulf of Alaska. President Reagan today called the recently negotiated deficit reduction agreement an all-or-nothing deal. The president told a group of business leaders in Washington today that the compromise worked out with Congress is not perfect, but he said it would be adequate. He suggested that he would not accept changes to the plan, especially if they resulted in higher taxes. The speech did little to calm investors who were still wary after last month's crash. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged almost 75 points to 1833.55. Declines led advances 13-1 on volume of 267 million shares. The dollar slid to record lows today, fanning investors' fears that higher interest rates and inflation are on the way. Retired House Speaker Tip O'Neill underwent prostate surgery this morning in Boston. David Barron of member station WBUR reports.
Doctors say O'Neill is doing well following the removal of much of his enlarged prostate. Jerome Ritchie of Brigham and Women's Hospital performed the 90-minute operation. He says prostate trouble is common in older men, and he saw no evidence of malignancy.
There is no suspicion of prostate cancer. This is merely benign enlargement of the gland.
But the doctor adds cancer can't be ruled out until laboratory results are completed in a few days. O'Neill is still recovering from an operation for rectal cancer 2 weeks ago. The former speaker should be out of the hospital in a week to 10 days. For National Public Radio, this is David Barron in Boston.
South Korean officials today are saying that a time bomb-like device could have been responsible for the disappearance of a Korean airliner on Sunday. The Boeing 707 with 115 people aboard went down in dense jungle in Thailand near its border with Burma. The remote jungle location of the crash has hampered rescue efforts there. Officials say the bomb could possibly have been planted by terrorists seeking to disrupt planning for the Seoul Olympics. This is NPR News. I'm Dale Willman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album from bassist Dave Holland and his quintet. Holland was born in England 41 years ago and played jazz and free improvised music there before coming to America with Miles Davis in 1968. From the late 60s through the mid-70s, Holland was involved in several long-term collaborations with reed players Anthony Braxton and Sam Rivers, pianist Chick Corea, and drummer Barry Altschul. The term free bop was used to describe their blend of structured and improvised music. The quintet Holland now leads also plays in that style. Kevin says Holland's bass playing and band leading are almost equally fine.
From the time he arrived in the States in 1968, it was clear that Dave Holland was a giant of the upright bass. He had everything: unerring pitch, precise articulation, and a busy, propulsive style. He'd run rings around the harmonies and push the band along at the same time. Lately, though, Holland has become more than a mere virtuoso. His sound has deepened, become more warm and round. He puts a little more trust in simplicity. Dave Holland has always been as interested in refining small group structures as in perfecting the art of playing the bass. In 1972, he cut a classic quartet album, Conference of the Birds, which left its many admirers hungry for more. But it wasn't until the early 80s that Holland founded a working band, a quintet, whose third album is The Razor's Edge on ECM. The group includes trumpeter Kenny Wheeler, alto saxophonist Steve Coleman, and trombonist Robin Eubanks, three horn players who can sound both pretty and tough. Rounding it out is the seemingly ubiquitous drummer Marvin Smitty Smith. Holland's quintet is simply one of the finest working groups around, both hot and lyrical, adventurous and accessible. The group's sound is its own, but its spirit owes a lot to bassist Charles Mingus's great 1960 quintet, in which the bassist's riffs and rhythmic phrases define the course of an improvisation, and in which it was a cardinal rule that nobody stayed out of the action for long. While one horn player was soloing, the other two would sketch in section riffs in the background, giving the illusion of a larger band. Holland's quintet does the same. It's heard at its best on Brother Ty, written by drummer Doug Hammond, a regular contributor to the band's book. Kenny Wheeler's solo makes the case that he's one of the most deeply expressive brass players in jazz. He has an oddly satisfying mix of melancholy tone, eerie vocalizations, and bop chops. Brother Ty. Thank you.
With this group, Dave Holland has found relief from formulaic structures too many musicians cling to, the monotony of endless strings of unrelated solos over inobtrusive walking rhythm. Holland's not afraid of strict 4-4 time, but he knows he doesn't have to walk the bass to swing the band. His time is so strong, he frees up drummer Smith to add color or fill up odd spaces here and there instead of smacking out the beat. Kenny Wheeler and Steve Coleman, members of the band since its inception, break down the boundaries between so-called inside and outside blowing. They sound lyrical even when they wander far from the chords the bass implies. Robin Eubank's trombone may blend seamlessly with Wheeler's trumpet, paint dark streaks against a plain backdrop, or echo the tailgate style of the 20s. For all Holland's instrumental prowess and structural ambition, there's nothing clinical about this music. He's one conceptualist who's not afraid to feel, a feeling musician who's not afraid to explore. So if you like your jazz pretty but find Wynton Marsalis just a little too tame, Dave Holland's quintet may be exactly what you're looking for.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat, Cadence, and Jazz Times. He reviewed The Razor's Edge, the new album from Dave Holland and his quintet on ECM. You're listening to Fresh Air. In the late 70s, Los Angeles was the center of a new wave of underground, hard-driving rock music. One of the bands that sprung up during that period and continues to generate a loyal cult following is the group X. X made their first album, Los Angeles, in 1980. Their sixth album is called See How We Are. My guests are two of the band's original members, singer-songwriter and bass guitarist John Doe and singer-songwriter Exene Cervenka. I asked John Doe if he had a sound in mind when he started X.
Basically, we wanted to offer something alternative that paid attention to lyrics and had a history of rock and roll music, you know, and all that includes. But as far as the sound we got, it was developed out of just the natural tendencies that we had.
Were you looking for a sound that was rough, kind of raw?
To a certain extent, only because the rest of music at that point was so over-processed and produced and safe.
As opposed to now, when everything's overproduced, overprocessed, and safe.
Exene, when X got started, you had been an avant-garde poet. What was it like when you first started singing? Had you sung at home a lot? Had you been used to singing?
No, I never sung a note in my life. What it was like was it didn't matter if you could sing or if you had ever sung before. That was the point of starting bands then. It was like kind of the same thing as people at home picking up an instrument so they can sing around the piano or something and entertain their kids and be musical. It's just for your basic spirit, you know, just to do something.
What was the music scene like in Los Angeles when you got started?
There wasn't really any music scene. What was going on was a lot of big-time groups were doing showcases and getting signed to record company contracts. The live music was basically disco, cover bands, and top 40. So you had the major city, music city in the United States without a live local music scene. It was as if someone gave us the keys to the city and said, here, go forth and conquer.
In the time it takes to pay my hotel bill, I can lose my mind, walk out the door, I'm going to know. Everything I want's been down many times, and I've been at one and no time to get it wrong.
Do you wake up
at midnight in the middle of the room, beating on a door that's locked?
Well, I do.
When you were playing during the punk scene in Los Angeles in the late 70s, there was a lot of what really appeared to outsiders to be very violent and aggressive reactions, slam dancing in which people would kind of like knock
later.
Into each other. That was after you were performing?
That came more like in 81, 82, when the hardcore scene kind of got involved. When we started out for the first like 3 years or so, if I was singing a song and I felt like, gee, I think I'll just go in the audience now. It was great, you know, people wouldn't grab you in unfriendly places, and they wouldn't hit you, and they wouldn't do things to you. Then all of a sudden, like in 1981, towards the end, I think it was, I could be off by as much as a year, all these like really weird people started coming with their heads shaved, and they started spitting at the band and screaming at us and saying they hated us and jumping up on stage, and it just was really ruined.
As you started getting better known, some of your initial audiences, some of your first audiences who were still very devoted listeners, started to think, well, gee, maybe these guys are selling out. And in 1981, Billboard had a short article that was headlined, LA Group X Refutes Charges That It's Sold Out.
Oh, I remember that.
I thought that was really funny. I mean, considering that so many people had never even heard of you and, like, you're refuting charges that you've sold out.
Yeah, it's tragic, isn't it, that people can be so silly about stuff like that. It's just because people feel real personal about us and they don't want us to go away or change. They want us to be their own personal band, and of course, that's nice and we appreciate that, but you do need to make a living at some point in your life.
You write really interesting songs, and the songs that you both write are frequently scenes, almost like little scenarios, a short story. And there's a lot of detail in the lyrics. Can you tell me what you think makes a good lyric?
I think what makes a good lyric to me is a good writer. No, it's true. And then you have to define what a good writer is.
Uh-huh.
And the only way you can define what a good writer is just by reading something and saying, God, that's good.
Can you tell me how you wrote See How We Are?
See How We Are was written over about a 4-month period. And I knew it was going to be a special song, so I didn't rush it. I just waited until I had different experiences to write the different verses.
There I've been lost in jail, crowded 52 room. There's too many rats in this cage of the world. And the women know their place, they sit home and write letters. Then they visit once a year. Where they both just sit there and stare. See how we are. Gotta keep bars in between us. See how we are. We only sing about it once in every 20 years. See how we are. Oh, see how we are. Now there are some kinds of coke, 500 kinds of cigarettes. This freedom of choice in the USA drives everybody crazy. Down in Acapulco, well, they don't give a damn. Back in San Chiclis with no shoes on their feet. See how we are. Hey, man, what's in it for me? See how we are. We only sing about it once in every 20 years. See how we are.
There have been some changes in the band in the past few years. You both used to be married, and now you're divorced from each other. You're each, I believe, married to somebody else now. Was it hard to keep the band together as the marriage was breaking up?
Not really. They're two different things.
Both of you have started acting careers. Exene, you were in the film Salvation.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and John, you've been in a couple of movies, Borderline Radio and Slam Dance.
Yeah, it's called Border Radio.
Border Radio, thanks.
And Slam Dance, and I had a small part in Salvador.
Is there a kind of role that you aspire to now?
Just one that doesn't involve rock and roll.
Yeah.
Because you want to have an acting career independent from music?
Yeah. Well, as soon as somebody in movies hears that John Doe or Exene or Sting or whoever the hell is acting, then they send them scripts where they play rock and roll musicians. And that's not acting, and it's not fun. So you just say thank you very much, but I'd rather do something where I play a homicide detective.
You're 8 months pregnant, Exene. Mm-hmm. How do you think having a baby is going to affect your music?
My husband's a real big X fan, so he wants to come on the tour and bring the baby and make a big happy family out of it. So we may stay doing this, and if it's too hard, I'll just quit and do something else.
Have you gotten any strange reactions from fans who aren't used to seeing pregnant performers on stage?
I think most people are just real happy. They see it and they go, God, that's great. Exene's going to have a baby.
On the other hand, you have the really astute observer who, when we walk on stage, looks at me and says, my God, he's got a beard. and she's standing right in front of Exene.
Oh, that's really a riot.
John's got a beard, though, too.
Yeah, I do. But, I mean, she mm-hmm. completely missed the fact that Exene was 8 months pregnant.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I wish you the best, and I thank you both very much for talking with us.
Right on. We'll see you later.
Exene Cervenka and John Doe of the rock band X. Their new album, See How We Are, is on Elektra Records. They spoke to us from KQED in San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne co-hosts the program, and she's joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, tonight we'll have more on the election violence in Haiti. Criticisms from Haitians living in this country on the way the Reagan administration handled the government of Henri Namphy as the elections approached. They charged the White House ignored indications that those in power in Haiti were doing very little to ensure fair, violence-free voting there. Also, a report on au pair, well, they used to be called au pair girls. Now, I guess it's young men and women. Here in this country, families where both parents work have problems with daycare, so many are turning to a time-honored European tradition, au pair girls.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Twenty-four new television shows premiered this fall on the three major networks. Of those, several have already been canceled, and several more may be close to getting the axe. But one new show is doing exceedingly well in the ratings. Our television critic David Bianculli has an historical overview of the success of freshman TV shows.
If the so-called second season in January doesn't produce a surprise smash hit, it looks like only one new series will wind up in the top 10 at the end of the season next April. That show is NBC's A Different World, which, if current trends continue, will wind up in second place for the year, right behind its parent program, The Cosby Show. Let's forget about the fact that A Different World is a stupid show. What bugs me is that it benefits so much by being scheduled right behind Cosby on Thursday nights. Merely by riding that tidal wave, A Different World should end up ranked second during its freshman season. 3 years ago, when The Cosby Show premiered, it wound up in third place, but it did it without any help. It's not easy for a new show to crack the top 10. The year after The Cosby Show and Murder, She Wrote made the list, only The Golden Girls cracked the top 10 as a freshman. Last season, no new show did it. And if A Different World actually finishes second, it'll be accomplishing something only two other programs have done in TV's long, weird history. Which ones? Not so fast. Let's have a little fun with this and make it even tougher. The category is television, and the final Jeopardy answer is the only TV show in history to finish its freshman season in first place. I'll even give you a clue. It's a sitcom. Okay, contestants, write down your questions. Time's up. Let's hear what you've got. The Dick Van Dyke Show? The Mary Tyler Moore Show? No, I'm sorry. MASH? Nope. Those all were great shows, but none of them made the top 20 their first year, much less the top 10. All in the Family? Same story. I Love Lucy? Now you're getting warm. I Love Lucy was an immediate smash, but it ended its first year in third place, same as The Cosby Show. The Honeymooners? Classic sitcom, but not so classic ratings. Didn't even place. Try something a little newer, into the 60s at least. And try something dumber. Laverne and Shirley? Believe it or not, that show ranked second the year it premiered, in a situation uncannily similar to that of A Different World today. It was a spin-off of a hit show, Happy Days, and was scheduled right after it on the same night. Laverne and Shirley was one of the two second-place freshman finishers I mentioned earlier. The other, and here's another believe it or not, was Bewitched. All right, enough suspense. What one show in the entire history of TV shot to the very top of the ratings during its very first season? Listen to one final clue, an audio daily double. That's right, The Beverly Hillbillies. I can't believe it either. But of the zillions of shows, the zillions of better shows on TV, it was the one to strike gold. Black gold. Texas Tea.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Well, the first thing you know, old Jed's a millionaire. Kinfolk said, Jed, move away from there. He said, California is the place you ought to be. So he loaded up the truck and they moved to Beverly Hills, that is, swimming pools. Movie star.
Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with jazz drummer and composer Bobby Previtt. He has a new album. Also, rock critic Ed Ward will profile James Carr, a little-known 60s soul singer who some considered the equal of Otis Redding and Wilson Pickett. And book critic John Leonard will review Chile, Death in the South, by Jacobo Timmerman, the former Argentine newspaper publisher who was imprisoned for publishing the names of people who disappeared during Argentina's junta in the mid-70s. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Audrey Vablitis. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.